BioCentury This Week is brought to you by Jato Capital, a global leading independent private equity fund dedicated to biopharma. Jato Capital has built a patient benefit-driven approach aimed at financing and accelerating the development of groundbreaking medical innovation. Jato's unique investment strategy combines significant capital and expert support to companies and their management teams, ranging from clinical development to market access for cutting-edge innovations with one main objective: go faster for the patient. Learn more at jato.life.
Welcome to BioCentury This Week, the podcast with BioCentury's editorial team. I'm Jeff Cranmer, executive editor here at BioCentury, and joining me today are my colleagues,
Simon Fishburn, editor-in-chief,
Paul Bonanos, director of Biopharma Intelligence,
and Steve Austin, Washington editor.
On today's podcast, Vertex's $4.9 billion takeout of immune company Alpine, how Goldman Sachs's life sciences strategy aims to scale private biotechs, and BioCentury's latest in our series of stories on the impact of the Inflation Reduction Act. All right, well, I had a week away, and Simone, I hear you were talking up our new conference, the Grand Rounds, which will be in September. What did I miss?
You missed the debut, talking about our debut version of Grand Rounds, our first R&D or R&D dedicated conference that we are all hopping with excitement about, that really focuses on the academia industry interface. I know you're going to put links in the show notes, Jeff. So I will just say, if you are an early stage company, or not even a company, if you are a translational researcher looking to spin out a company, take a look. This is the place for you. We want your posters. We want your presentations. And if you are a VC or a pharma looking to get the earliest of early, take a look. This is also for you. And if you are somebody who is really interested in having thought leaders discuss the really critical interface in scientific topics that sit between academia and industry, or in both academia and industry, we will be rolling out some specific topics fairly soon. Then take a look, check out our website.
And it will be in Nashville, which obviously I'm a little biased toward Tennessee, but it's a cool town.
We are also preparing to announce some rather cool Nashville-focused activities.
Excellent, excellent. But first, we have our Bioequity Europe conference coming up in San Sebastian, Spain. That's in Basque country, and that'll be in May. And Simone will be taking off for that. I think you're working on the scene setter for that right now, are you not?
I am. I'm going back and forth with my colleagues on a lot of data, where what we're really looking at, which is the theme of the conference, is rising above the noise. So what are the attributes that made companies stand out in a bad market? You know, in Europe, those that raised a fair amount of money or signed a pharma deal. And that's the conference theme. We have a really great lineup of panels and panelists, and that conference is, might even be getting sold out as we speak. I know it's very in demand this year, as ever.
Of course, the culinary magnificence of San Sebastian, no doubt, contributing a bit to that. All right, well, let's dig into Vertex. Last week, Vertex Pharmaceuticals announced a nearly $5 billion deal to acquire Alpine Immune Sciences that could help the company expand beyond its blockbuster cystic fibrosis franchise. It's the largest ever deal for Vertex and the year's largest biotech takeout, at least so far. Paul, you dug into this one. What attracted Vertex to this company?
I can tell you, yes, about their lead asset, which is most advanced for IgA nephropathy, an autoimmune disorder that manifests also as a kidney disorder. And as you say, this is part of a very long push by Vertex to diversify. They've been all about cystic fibrosis on the commercial side for a long time. They do have a launch in progress outside of CF. That's Casgevy, Casgevy, do they say, the gene editing drug for sickle cell disease and beta thalassemia. But they've been building in other areas for a long time. I know people are very excited about their non-opioid pain reliever. It's got some attention. They have some other programs in the musculoskeletal area, diabetes, alpha-1 antitrypsin, and then also kidney disease. So this is actually, it builds on two other programs in kidney disease, and the IgA nephropathy therapy from Alpine makes three. So what they get is a molecule called povetacicept. Mercifully, they say POVI for short. And I'll go with POVI for the purposes of this podcast. It's an antagonist of two targets. One of them is BAF, aka BLIS. The other is APRIL. They're both on the same pathway, but Vertex and Alpine have made the case that the dual inhibition promises more efficacy than single inhibition of one target or the other. And indeed, there are some BAF-only and APRIL-only programs out there. Will that bear out in the clinic? It's hard to say because Alpine's data thus far are very early and are in very few patients. But the endpoint that they've used, proteinuria reduction, which is an approvable endpoint we've seen for accelerated approval, suggests that POVI is a contender for sure. There's another BAF-APRIL dual program ahead of it from Vera Therapeutics that's already in phase three. Alpine's, or now Vertex's, is going into phase three this year. But at the same time point in earlier studies, again, with the caveat that cross-trial comparisons make things difficult, and again, it's very early data for the Alpine program, but it did lead to a greater proteinuria reduction than the Vera one or some of the others we've seen that are single inhibitors. So it's very early. The pivotal trial will tell us more, but that's what Vertex is kind of placing its bet on thus far.
Yeah, so Paul, one thing I was interested in here is, you know, Vertex have clearly gone for something that they think is going to be best in class, because it's not going to be first in class, right? And, you know, we talk a lot about first in class, best in class. Do you think that's a fair gamble for them because they don't yet have that data? I know you've lined up some of the data and it sort of looks good, but how different is it for Vertex or companies like this to go in with something that it's still to be determined if it's going to be best in class? I mean, that's $5 billion down on that.
That's right. And like I say, the proteinuria number that they have is better so far, but it's only in a handful of patients. There is also a dosing advantage. So that's kind of a differentiator to fall back on, even if it's just as good entering in the same class as Vera's. And of course, it's still early enough that who knows what's going to happen in either phase three trial. If one of these is going to fail and the other would be alone in the class for a while. But moreover, Vertex sees this as a pipeline and a product as well. There are more indications that they could add in, more kidney indications and also cytopenias. And part of the idea of such an acquisition is that Vertex, being, you know, a much richer company, better funded company, means that they can accelerate the broader development plan, right? They can make everything happen faster in a bunch more indications. So
the other thing, Paul, is that, you know, Vertex has taken a lot of drugs to market, has a lot of commercial expertise in getting the drug out there. Do you think that they feel that they can compete at that level as well?
Yes. I mean, I don't think they've proven anything in kidney disease yet, but obviously their commercial strength in cystic fibrosis, you know, they've been dominating that market for a long time and really dominating the disease. They bring so much more strength than a small biotech could. So if they're not going to be first to market, then, you know, they certainly believe they have the best in class molecule, but compared with a smaller biotech coming to market, they would obviously have commercial strengths that a company of Vera's size does not.
Well, and the other thing to think about there is, in a post-IRA world, the ability to launch or to study multiple indications really quickly is going to be really important, right? Because the clock is going to be ticking on this as soon as it gets approved.
Yes, indeed. So add it all up, they think they're best in class, even if they're not first to market. And I think that is a major driver of the deal. That's the sentiment that came out a couple of times during the conference call as Vertex announced it.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Let's turn to venture financing now. 2 years ago, Goldman Sachs launched a new life sciences strategy. Paul, you spoke with the firm's Amit Sinha recently to learn more. What did you find out?
Yeah, so it is a relatively new strategy. It's been in the works for a few years, But they announced the final close of their first fund, which is called West Street Life Sciences, in January at $650 million. I was able to speak with Amit not long ago, really a few weeks ago, and we published the story just as the latest deal came out, which is a company called Alterome that announced a Series B this month and $132 million. Okay, so as far as the new strategy goes, obviously Goldman is an enormous firm. They've had a presence in PE and investment banking for, you know, obviously a long time, and healthcare has been part of those businesses. But this is something fairly new. It's a direct investment strategy in life sciences with a discrete fund. And the idea is behind it is, from my conversation with Amit, was that they had started to notice the changing dynamics around expectations for private and public biotechs. He was of the mind that we're going to see more life sciences companies stay private for longer, and they'll need more private capital to scale before the idea of going public, you know, would be a good or viable option for a lot of biotech companies. We saw for a few years there a lot of kind of underbaked companies going public that couldn't get out now. And he said that the team recognized that this had kind of been true on the tech side for a while, that companies were staying private for longer and scaling with private dollars. And once a correction kicked in on the public side, the firm anticipated that there would be more need for growth capital for companies to scale before going public. And that is the niche that they appear to be trying to fill. So that latest deal, Alterome, the precision oncology company, is very much in line with the others. They're coming in a Series B round, a nine-digit Series B, as many of their other deals have been. There have been only six. Most have been Series B. Most have been in that range. They're following well-known venture firms in. They're not really doing company creation on their own as far as academic spinouts go. And the way he put it, Amit said, you know, there are other firms that are much better equipped to do that than us. But when they reach a certain point where they're maybe about to enter the clinic or have entered the clinic already, and there are more milestones coming up, something to prove, they are coming in, Goldman Sachs is, with capital to scale.
Hey, Paul, I have a question about this. Do you know whether their focus is largely on US-based companies? And one of the reasons that I ask is, especially as we come up to BioEquity Europe, you know, a particular constraint in Europe is this growth capital, is this idea of really being able to flesh out and get the company to the right stage before needing to tap the public markets. So, you know, that kind of patient capital, growth capital is really needed there. Is Goldman Sachs mostly focused in the US, or do they have a Europe angle as well?
You know, he didn't mention any geographic constraints when we spoke. I think all six deals have been in the US thus far. I believe they're open to deals from all over the world. And I agree that there are some capital needs that you're describing from non-US companies. But thus far, they've been following up firms like Third Rock. Three of the six deals are Third Rock companies launched in the US, I believe all of them. And they've come in behind firms like Arch and Versant before too. So, you know, these are firms with long track records of making fairly big bets on early stage science with worthwhile assets moving into and through the clinic. So they're going to play the role of advancing these projects. Again, not at creation, not coming in that early, but identifying ones that are kind of ready to level up while still private, putting in tens of millions. I think 30, 35 would be the average commitment from Goldman, and keeping some reserves to keep scaling while still private if the market isn't really receptive to going public, and, you know, hopefully reach probably some clinical milestones. You know, like we've been saying all along, almost all of the companies going public are at least in the clinic now. And the ones that have been performing best on the open market are the ones that have hit some clinical milestones, have some clinical data. And ideally, I imagine that most of these companies that Goldman is backing would be able to show some clinical evidence for at least one therapy before attempting to go public down the line.
All right. Thanks for that, Paul. Let's turn to the Inflation Reduction Act. Steve, you are finishing a story that you're working on with our colleague Richard Guy about the IRA. You're reading the tea leaves on pricing of the first 10 drugs. What have you and Richard come up with?
So the IRA Medicare drug price negotiations, they're taking place behind closed doors. So far, none of the drug companies participating in the process have revealed the details. They fought to be able to have the ability to talk about them, but so far none of them have done so, and I don't expect any will. So you can't really predict what the outcomes are now, but what you can do and what we are doing is looking at what are the key factors that are most likely to determine the prices in the first cohort of drugs, and what is that going to mean going forward? How are investors and companies going to interpret it? We're not the only ones looking at this. There was a really interesting set of analyses conducted by a team of researchers at the Duke Margolis Center for Health Policy, and I spoke with their director, Mark McClellan, about it. Their analysis and the look that we did at the situation also suggests that the most important decision that CMS is going to make, and probably it already has made it, we just don't know, is whether it's going to compare the prices of the drugs that are subject to negotiation with comparators, that is, with other drugs, that are as similar as possible, or if they're going to use less similar drugs, perhaps from other classes that may be used for the same indications. So I'll back up a little bit and explain why that's important. The negotiated price for most of the 10 drugs, the start of the negotiation is going to be the net price that Medicare already pays. Okay. And that's because the way that the law is set up, they're either going to start with a minimum discount, that is a ceiling price of a certain discount from the average manufacturer's price or the net price. Most of these drugs are heavily rebated, so the net price is going to be the lower price. That's going to be the ceiling. So then you say, okay, well, where's the floor going to be? And there's been a lot of commentators who said, we've said that the law doesn't specify a floor, so it leaves it up to everybody's imagination where the floor is going to be. But what the law does say is it says CMS has to compare the price of drugs that are being negotiated with another drug. And it doesn't say what that drug is or how it should do that comparison. What we've done and what the team at Duke Margolis did was to say, well, look, if you compare it to the closest drug, to the most similar drug that's on the market, that's likely going to result in a price that's going to be very similar to what the net price already is. If you compare it, on the other hand, to something that's more distant, you may get a lower price, and you're likely to get a lower price. And the example would be for Eliquis and Xarelto, which were both selected for a price negotiation. The most similar drug in each case is each other, right? But you could compare them to warfarin. Warfarin's a generic drug. It's far cheaper. It's used for the same indication. But clinicians would say, and patients would say, that warfarin is an inferior drug. So the reason that this is important, I think, is not just because it's going to tell you how CMS is going to look at these prices going forward and what the prices of negotiated drugs might be going forward, but it's going to send in a really important signal to drug developers. It's going to show whether CMS is going to be willing to reward the development of drugs with superior safety or efficacy, or if the pricing for all drugs for an indication is going to be referenced against the lowest price alternative, regardless of its comparative value. That's really right. Critically important. If you want to get new drugs that are better than existing drugs, then there has to be signals from CMS that they're going to be willing to pay for them.
Right. So, Steve, a couple of things there. Is it the case that what they do in one scenario has to be the same as what they do in another? The warfarin example that you gave is a really clear one because most people know warfarin is a terrible drug. There's lots of ways to improve upon it. But I wonder if it's the case in every scenario that there is something that the lowest price drug is such a sort of step down, or the new drugs are such a step up from there. So the one question I have is whether it really is a sign of the way they're going to do something all the time.
Well, you're right. There's not always going to be something that they can reach for that's going to be, you know, clearly inferior safety or efficacy that's cheaper. But if you think about it, it's likely to be the case a lot of the time, because by definition, these are drugs that have been on the market for quite some time. So there's likely going to be some kind of alternative to those drugs. The other thing that we don't know, of course, is a couple of things. One, it's not necessarily going to be binary. It's not necessarily, for example, in the case of the anticoagulants, of whether they use warfarin or if they use the better branded drugs as a comparator. It may be that CMS comes up with some kind of a model where they mix the prices from the older one and the newer ones. There are also other factors that they may consider. So the law allows or requires companies to submit data about what their cost of manufacturing is, what their cost of marketing is, how much money they've received from the federal government and various programs. And so it may be that CMS uses that data in some way to modify the negotiated price up or down.
So, Steve, obviously, I'm assuming the pharmaceutical industry is pushing for what they want. What do you expect the next steps to be in this? And how soon will it be that manufacturers get these signals that you're talking about?
Well, it's going to be September 1, right, when the prices come out. The manufacturers that are involved in the negotiations now, of course, have a pretty good idea of where CMS is going with this, but they haven't told us. Everybody's going to find out by September 1st what the negotiated prices are. And also, CMS is going to have to reveal, at least in broad terms, how they got to those prices. Like I said, I think that's going to send a tremendously important signal to drug developers going forward about whether or not CMS is willing to reward them for producing drugs that are better than existing drugs, or if really the only avenue that they're going to have for maintaining pricing after the price negotiation period starts is if they're the only drug that's available for a particular condition.
Right. So just to, you know, recap from previously, we know that companies are, many of the big pharmas, whatever, are now looking at this as effectively a loss of exclusivity sort of event. Is this something that if CMS changed that floor, as you put it, might change their way of thinking about an LOE scenario?
Yeah, I think so. I think that this is really an opportunity that CMS has to use public policy to shape the future of drug development and to determine whether it's going to go in directions that are, in the long run, better for the public health, or if they produce short-term savings for the program and for the taxpayers.
All right. Thanks for that, Steve. Links to the stories we discussed today can be found in the show notes. And coming up this week on BioCentury, Editor-in-Chief Simone Fishburn in conversation with Bristol-Myers Head of Research, Robert Plenge, on the BioCentury Show. You'll find that on our YouTube channel beginning on Thursday. Thanks for tuning in. We'll catch you next week. Kendall Square Orchestra provides the music for BioCentury this week. The group connects science and technology professionals and other members of the greater Boston community to collaborate, innovate, inspire through music while supporting causes related to healthcare and education.
BioCentury would like to thank Jato Capital for its continued support of our BioCentury This Week podcast and our 24th annual BioEquity Europe Conference this May in San Sebastian.